Hello, this is Robert Cartwright from the Institute of Classical Osteopathy, and welcome to the Classical Osteopathy Podcast and my interview with Alice Williams. Alice is the Foundation Director at the Institute of Classical Osteopathy, and one of her roles, of many, which she's very passionate about, is to take osteopaths who enroll on our courses on the journey of discovery to understand that their view depends upon where they are looking from, which is often quite a difficult paradigm shift for people. But this is the start for how we help osteopaths develop their osteopathic thinking. And in fact, Andrew Taylor Still went through this shift in his thinking, moving from a medical perspective to osteopathic thinking when he discovered osteopathy. Alice is one of the brightest people I've had the pleasure of working with, and originally did a degree in physics at Imperial before doing the most important job you can have, being a parent, and then training as an osteopath at Nescott. Today I'm interviewing Alice Williams. Alice is the Foundation Director at the Institute of Classical Osteopathy, and she is the key person who is involved in organising and teaching on the Institute of Classical Osteopathy postgraduate diploma in classical osteopathy. So I think I first met you, Alice, probably about 10 years ago, and it was through the Institute, and I thought I'd met you before. And I think I can't remember who it was who introduced us. I think I probably can, but anyway, I can't remember exactly who it was. But they said, "Have you met Alice before?" And I said, "Yes, I think I have." And you said, "No, I don't think you have." And I realised later on that you look very similar to an ex-girlfriend of mine. From
oh no,
did you? and. The ex-girlfriend was actually from school, but I only see her on Facebook these days, you know, and you look very, very similar. So that must have been where I'd met you from. But anyway, that was probably about 2012, 2013, something like that. So what we're going to do initially is just talk about the Institute and your role there, I think, Alice, if that's okay.
Okay. So
what makes osteopaths do the Institute courses?
We get a lovely mixture of people coming on the course. We get people who've literally just graduated, and we get people who've been working as osteopaths for 10, 20 years. You know, and I always ask people when they come on the course why they're there. That's kind of like the first thing I want to know about them, and that they always say the same things, that they feel like something's been missing from osteopathy. Now, either missing in their course, you know, they've done just on the course and didn't feel they got what they paid for, or missing from their practice in terms of scope of practice and being able to treat everything that walks in. So the rationale for that, if you like. So the three things they say that they're missing are principles, scope of practice, and rationale for treatment.
That's exactly why, as you know, that's exactly why I went to the Institute, because and when I talk to people about this, and I mention this quite often, I say I did 40,000 to 50,000 treatments, and then I realised something wasn't quite right. And I remember you saying to me, "How did it take you so long?"
Did I?
I wanted to make sure. You know?
that sounds like the sort of thing I might say.
Yeah. So how do you assess what's missing, or do you not need to do that with students? Do you have to work out where they are when they first join?
They do tend to be in a similar place, really. You know, because what's happened is they've gone to college to learn what osteopathy is, and somewhere along the way, the whole of that has got submerged in the process of being examined and learning all the answers, because you have to do a lot of learning at college. You have to learn. It's like learning a new language in so many ways. They have to learn all the anatomy and all the physiology and all the pathology and all the neurology, and they just somehow they never seem to quite get how to put that together. It's like they're learning all the leaves on the tree, but the principal side of it seems to have got forgotten. Mm. And so they come out with lots of knowledge. I mean, you know, the people on our course, they're not lacking in knowledge. They're usually very good students, very knowledgeable. Mm.
And what's usually the main challenge, or what are the main challenges in the early stages or through the foundational stage?
The main thing that you've got to do is the first step, if you like, the first thing that's going to need sort of, the first thing they're going to need to see is they're going to need to see where they're already looking from. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because obviously what you see does depend where you're standing.
Yeah, so they come with the presuppositions of an allopathic medical thought process.
Mm.
And they don't know they've got them, because that's the presupposition of our society. That's our cultural context.
Yeah.
So the first thing you've got to help them realise is they've already got a way of looking. Mm. It's not that they don't. Mm. It's they've already got one, and that's what's getting in the way of them seeing the thing they're missing from osteopathy.
Mm.
So they've got to see that bit first, and that's actually quite tricky. Because it's like Andrew Taylor Still, you know, that the first he was practicing as a medical practitioner, and it was only when he rejected that way of looking at things that he found he could see things differently. It's only when he rejected that process that he started looking for an alternative, and that's when he said he discovered osteopathy, because he used those words that he used. He said it was a discovery, and he discovered it through observation and clinical practice. And that's really the fascinating thing, the fact that anybody can do it, but we've got something standing in our way to start with.
Mm.
You know, our natural interest in what's going on with patients has been submerged by this alternative sort of, by this presupposition of allopathic medicine.
It is really interesting when you look at it from that perspective, isn't it? Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. It is really interesting when you look at it from that perspective, because you don't, or people don't realise that there's different ways of looking or standing in a different place to see something.
No, that's right. And it's because when you're standing on a viewing platform, you see the view. You don't look at the platform you're standing on. You look at the view from the platform.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why people struggle with it as an idea.
So at the end of the foundational stage, where do you kind of get the osteopaths that are doing the course to?
Okay, so the aim of the foundation course, but by the end of the course, what I want the student to be able to do is produce a detailed classical osteopathic diagnosis. And by that, I mean a detailed anatomical description that makes sense of the behaviour that their patient's coming in with. And it doesn't matter what the patient's coming in with. I really want them to have a thought process that can take them from that presenting complaint to an understanding of how come that bit's complaining. And it sounds simple, but really that's the missing bit that they've got. They don't know how to do that. They don't know how to take a symptom, a pain, whether it's pain or loss of function or whatever it is, they don't know how to take that and say, how come that's happening?
Mm.
And that's really the main thing I want them to be able to do. We also teach them body adjustment. So we teach them a physical lexicon, if you like, for interacting in a whole body way with a patient so that they can change that arrangement so that it doesn't need to do the symptom anymore, whatever it is.
Mm.
That's the aim.
Okay. How did you first hear of osteopathy?
Oh, how did I first hear about it? Gosh, I think I must have had osteopathic treatment when I was in my 20s, and I don't know how that came about. I mean, I know I had backache, and I was looking for somebody to give me some treatment. I'd had physiotherapy previously when I was younger, and yeah, I don't know. I ended up at an osteopath, and it was great.
So, and because it was your sort of second career, really, isn't it? Because you did a degree in physics at Imperial College, didn't you?
I did. Yes.
And then you went on to do, what did you do with that?
I did some work in the computer industry, a computer software house, which I absolutely hated. It was in the 80s when it sounded exciting, but it really wasn't.
Yeah.
So I left that to have kids, and then I was lucky enough to be able to be home with kids for a while. And then I was looking around for something else that I could do. And I didn't want to go back to that sort of office-based job that I'd been in before. And, I didn't think my body was up to doing an outdoor type job like gardening or whatever. But I wanted to stay in my local community and have something that I could fit around my family. And, you know, osteopathy just seemed like a good idea.
It is interesting how we come to it.
Yeah.
Sometimes, isn't it? Where did you train?
I trained at Nescott, that was really great. I mean, I'd actually I hadn't heard of it. I applied to go to the BSO. I got accepted at the BSO, and then, you know, just by chance heard about Nescott. And Nescott was much more local and, you know, much easier to manage that around a young family at the time. So yes, I went there, and it was a really lucky choice, because it meant I came across the classical stuff very early on.
Okay,
you know, my teachers were classical. And
did you enjoy the undergraduate experience? Obviously, you'd done your degree in physics at Imperial, and then obviously doing a degree in osteopathy. How did you find the undergraduate experience second time round?
It was horrific. Honest to God, it was really awful. And to start with, by year two, I was ready to give up.
Yeah.
And I really, really wasn't enjoying it. And it really hadn't given me what I thought it was going to give me. I had a fantastic principal's lecturer, Guy, in year one.
Yeah.
And he'd said, you know, the day I'd walked in practically, he'd said that osteopathy was a holistic therapy. And I thought, wow, that's, you know, that's great, because my physics degree, I'd actually done work on holograms and, in fact, computer generated holograms, which at the time was, you know, quite advanced to do that. And so I was really interested in the idea of holism and holistic things. And it just never occurred to me to apply that to the body. And it was like, oh, okay, that's fascinating. But he was the only person saying it. And although he was amazing in the way he was talking about things, the rest of the course really wasn't holistic. And I was getting more and more fed up with the whole business as I was going through the first 2 years. But then my principal's lecturer in year two, Mark, he sort of saw I was getting frustrated with the whole business and kind of started mentoring me, really. And then he said, you know, go see Henry for treatment, go down the ICO, see what they're doing on their foundation course. So I ended up doing the ICO foundation course when I was in my third year as an undergraduate. And that's what kept me going on the course, really. And meant I finished my degree, which was amazing.
So you mentioned that you were doing physics and your dissertation was about holograms and holism. How does that connect to holistic view of the body?
How can I put that? Okay, so our first principle of osteopathy is that the body is a unit. And that means it doesn't matter what you look at in the body, you are looking at the whole thing. You are looking at the whole, if you like. So a hologram is, things aren't recorded across the holographic plate in the same way as a photograph. If you had a photograph, you know, of me and you, say, and we had a row and tore it in half, and I put you in the bin, then you'd be in the bin and my bit would just have me on it. But if it was a hologram of you and me and I broke it in half, I couldn't get rid of you. We'd both be in both halves.
Right.
So you'd just be looking through a smaller window. So it doesn't matter when you look at the body, it doesn't matter if you look at, you know, a physical structure like a muscle, or if you look at the state of the heart, or if you look at the liver, or if you, you know, whatever you look at, you're looking at the whole thing.
It's a reflection of everything.
Yes, it's a window into the whole. Okay, if you looked at one cell, and you'd be looking at through a very small window.
But it's a picture. It's a picture of totality.
That's it, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, and like I say, my principal's lecturer guy in year one, when I got there, he said one of the first things he said was, "It's not the lesion in the body; it's the body in lesion." Mm. And I thought, yeah, that's right. Okay. Mm. Mm. Holism in a nutshell. Mm. And so that was amazing, and that sort of, that was a thought that I kept going back to for years, because actually when we've already got this allopathic way of thinking about the body and things going wrong in the body and being ill and, you know, having a pill to sort that out and all of those things, it's so ingrained in our thinking to think about things that way. To change that, even though I knew what holism was, to change that and think about the body in a different way was really, really hard. So I know the struggles that the students have got to do that shift in thinking. And I know it doesn't matter. They'll go, oh, yeah, I get it for a second. Yeah. And then they'll be back to where they started. And you have to have this continual practice of a way of thinking and a process that you can follow to guide your thoughts, so that you can continually practice the holistic way of doing it, as opposed to reverting back to your previous allopathic sort of cultural context that you're coming from.
Which is a default position, isn't it?
It's a default position. And you'll find yourself back there again and again and again. And it's so annoying. Mm. But, you know, the more you practice going the other way, the easier it gets. And the more automatic it becomes eventually.
Because it is very easy when you're listening to a lecture and or being taught something and you think, I get it. But then when you go to repeat it, you realise you don't.
Yes, exactly. I have this, my students say this to me all the time. They go, oh, Alice, it makes sense when you say it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, it can make sense when you say it as well. You've just got to go down that road and
embed it and understand it and live
exactly, and live it, and it's the ability to do that. I mean, you asked about the foundation course. That's what I'm after. I want to give the students a process so that at the end of the course, they've got this process, this thought process that they can always do.
So Karen, well...
No, I mean, there's lots of ways you can do that. I mean, you can go for sort of Pavlovian responses, or you can do lots of exercises where they practice doing it, or, you know, you could send them away to do written pieces, things like that. Mm.
So do you think this has changed at all since the days of Andrew Taylor Still?
What's changed?
Do you think osteopathy has changed... how it's been taught now, not by us, obviously, and particularly yourself. Do you think the way osteopathy is being taught now, has it morphed into something else then?
Oh, gosh. I don't think osteopathy has changed. But, you know, what's been taught as osteopathy, I don't think it can possibly be being taught, because we see so many people who haven't got it. You know, this the fact that the principles are missing from what people are saying where did they go? You know, the people who come on the course say they didn't have them. You see people out there who, you know, they are osteopaths, they are practicing osteopathy, great, you know, and that's fantastic, but I don't think they're doing what I'm talking about.
No. You're right. I've witnessed the same kind of thing, you know, sometimes when you've discussed this on social media, I've said that I don't really think the undergraduate colleges are teaching osteopathy, and they're not teaching the principles how they should. And then you can get someone who lectures at one of the undergraduate osteopathic institutions and says, "Yes, we do," but then it doesn't seem to kind of transmute through to the students. I don't think they.
I think it's a problem with teaching, because if we don't teach the people behind us to teach the people behind them, then how can they learn it? You know, they're not being exposed to it. So I don't blame the osteopaths who are out there who haven't been exposed to it for the fact that they don't get it. I mean, you know, that we're all somewhere, we're all working with bodies. So essentially at the end of the day, if they keep working with bodies for long enough, then they can discover it in the same way as Andrew Taylor Still did. But whether they'll ever get there, I don't know.
Do you think what you were taught differs from the osteopathy taught by people like Little John and Andrew Taylor Still?
I think it's different now because we know so much more about the body. So we have much more physiological knowledge, even though John Martin Little John was absolutely amazing for his time. There were things he simply didn't know about. I mean, I think the endocrine system was one. You know, the teaching I had at college was very reductive in terms of looking at things. It was very much about learning physiology, pathologies, learning the names, but not how come the body was doing those names. So to learn from my mentor, Mark, you know, the principles, and to then be looking at the consequences of altered structural arrangements and how they are the physiology that you're observing, the vital physiological processes that the body's doing, you know, that's a completely different thing. You know, how does the body get to this so-called name that whatever it is, you know, usually just the symptoms that have been translated into Latin or Greek or something. I mean, Little John had a great quote, didn't he? He said, "You can't diagnose a condition if by that is meant giving it a name." It's true. You know, you give it a name, so what? You know, it doesn't help.
Well, he would never give a medical diagnosis. He would, you know, and that was why. You know, he'd always give an osteopathic diagnosis. However, and people used to find that frustrating because they thought, well, he obviously doesn't know how to do a medical diagnosis. And actually, it's a lot more complicated doing an osteopathic diagnosis. It's, you know, rather than just saying, well, it's, you're in this pigeonhole.
My students will say, oh, the patient's got, I don't know, whatever, a strained ankle or whatever. And you'll go, okay, don't stop there. You know, how come? You know, why can't that tissue cope? What's happened to the supply and the demand on that tissue? What's happened to the blood supply to it, the drainage from it, the neurological control of the of the stabilization of the joint? You know, whatever, even just for something as simple as that, you know, all they want to do is say, oh, well, don't play squash and rest ice and compression and elevation. You're like, no, please. Let's move a bit beyond that, because it's there's a lot more to it than that.
So there's a concept in some versions of osteopathy. I say that slightly begrudgingly, because there is only one osteopathy. And people talk about a key lesion or a primary lesion. Is that something that you've come across?
I've come across it because you You talked to me about it earlier. My osteopathy has been the classical osteopathy. Mm. So the other sort of concepts that are elsewhere in osteopathy, I don't know so much about. Mm. But if you think, it depends what you think cause is. So it all comes down to ideas of cause. Mm. And if you're looking to chase cause around the body to find a primary lesion, you're not thinking holistically. Mm. So it's, you know, as long as you're in that blame culture, you know, the allopathic cultural context we've come from, mm. you're asking the wrong question. It contains the idea of a primary lesion or a key lesion contains the presupposition that something's gone wrong.
So you're saying this bit's wrong.
Yeah.
We need to fix it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's allopathic thought process.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the antithesis of osteopathy.
Exactly. It takes things in an opposite direction. There's nothing wrong with doing that.
Yeah.
And it's got its place. You know, if I break my leg, I'm going to go see the medics.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, if you want to practice osteopathy, that's not the thought process we want to be using.
So, as you know, with these interviews, and I have this kind of list of questions. So there's no need for me to ask you that. Do you still think that principles are important?
Yes, principles are important. Principles aren't what people think principles are, because principles are their rules, and we're going to apply them in our practice. Mm. No, they're not principles. Principles are descriptors of the view when you're standing in the osteopathic space. Mm. You know, and yes, you can have other principles, and they, you know, say, I don't know, you know, oh, gosh, I can't think of an example.
Yeah, it's always the principle of a key lesion.
Yes, you could have that. Yeah. But I mean, then you're describing the space that you're standing in for that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And that's not the same. That's not the same perspective, is it? It's a different perspective. Mm. So, yeah, principles are descriptors of the view, and they're terribly important if you want to find the osteopathic space to stand in.
Yeah. And so how do you tend to work with your patients?
In terms of treatment?
Yeah.
Oh, I use body adjustments.
Okay.
It's I mean, what can you say about body adjustment? Body adjustment, it's a language, it's a way of treating the whole body. It's a routine. By that I mean a route in to the body.
Route in.
Yes.
Is you break up the word routine.
Yes.
It's routine, isn't it? Yeah.
It's routine.
Yeah.
It's a route in to the body. It's a way of having a physical conversation. Mm. You know, if you want, because you're dealing with a living, vital being, you're not dealing with a machine where you can rearrange one bit and say, there you go.
Yeah.
You've got to have a conversation with the whole thing. Mm. And the whole thing, if you try and push it around, it's going to defend itself. That's your most common human reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you can't shove it around. You've got to have a chat with it.
Mm.
Like having a chat with a mate down the pub who you want to change his opinion.
Yeah.
How are you going to do it? Mm. Well, you're going to have a conversation, aren't you? Maybe an argument and a few beers, but
yeah. Punch up in the car park.
Yeah. So that's you're having a physical conversation with the body, and you've got to listen to what it's telling you.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you do that, then you'll feel it change, because it's, you know, if it's doing something that's using up its vital reserve and leaving it in a position that means it doesn't have sufficient vitality to respond to the demands of life, then if you can show it, it can be, you know, if it can see for itself that it actually, if it didn't do it the way it's doing and it's doing it and it moves somewhere else, it could be easier. And it'll do it. It's not going to waste energy doing stuff it doesn't need to do.
But so how do you get to that?
Physically.
Yeah.
with the body.
Yeah.
How does it happen? You feel it. I don't know how to explain it.
Okay. And you have to show it something a better option?
No, I wouldn't say that exactly. I think it has to see where it is.
Hmm.
Because like we talked about earlier, yeah, we're viewing from a particular perspective. We have to see where that is first.
Yeah.
Before we can see something else.
And is that an anatomical arrangement, or is that a mental kind of thought process thing for the patient?
I'm talking about physical, anatomical.
Yeah.
You know, you change, if the anatomy changes, then the physiology will change, won't it?
Yeah.
You know, because the anatomy has a behavior. Yeah. The structural arrangement has a behavior.
Mm.
So, you know, if you want to change the behavior, you've got to change the structural arrangement.
Yeah.
Okay. It's as simple as that. But mento-emotionally, exactly the same thing applies.
Mm.
You know, we will have a mento-emotional anatomy, a selection of thoughts and opinions and values that will have a certain set of behaviors in different circumstances.
Mm.
So the same principles apply. And I know people say, oh, you know, we shouldn't work psychosocially with people. I don't know, they do, don't they?
Yes, some people do. I think it's extremely important to.
It's outside the scope of practice or something, yeah, apparently. Yeah. Short of not talking to your patient.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how you avoid it.
Yeah.
You know, half of my patients are in tears by the time they're halfway through a treatment, you know.
Yeah.
Just because stuff comes out, you know, they can't help it. And, right, you know, what are you going to do? You've got to have a way of responding to that.
Mm.
And I think the principles work just as well.
Mm.
Whether you're thinking about, you know, a physical structure and its associated behavior, or a mental emotional structure and its associated behavior.
And it's that thing, the body is triune. You know, it's not just matter.
No. Mm. No, mind, matter, emotion, I think, still used, didn't it?
It's the whole thing.
Yeah. It's a vital organism, and I think understanding that whatever it's doing is vital, necessary physiological process, given where it is, is key, really, isn't it? You know, how do you change that? Because it is a vital process that's going on. You can't just bash in there and change it.
No.
Somehow that, you know, you're not going to heal the tissue. The body is going to do it.
Yeah.
So somehow you've got to have that physical conversation with the body.
Mm. Yeah.
So that the body goes, oh, hang on a minute, I don't need to be over here anymore. It would be a whole bunch easier if I was over there. Yeah. And then it does it. It does it. You're not going to wave a magic wand and heal tissue.
No. Our role isn't that, is it? You know,
No, it's not.
We just remove obstacles to natural recovery.
Yeah, it's more that you're going to see... You have to see that what the body's doing isn't wrong. It's vital and necessary.
Yeah.
It's not so much that you're taking away obstacles. No. It's that where they're viewing from, they can't see anything else. So that's why you need an osteopath there at the same time, so that they've got, I don't know, an outside reference point.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, yeah. Yeah, to see where you're seeing from,
yeah.
Yeah.
And if the body can see it for itself, then it won't be defending it anymore, will it?
No. It becomes not irrelevant, but unnecessary.
Redundant,
thank you, yeah. Yeah.
So if the body can register its own redundancy, that's something. Like I say, my mental mark came up with that one. then it will release it. And then you'll have a restoration, because you've got all of that vital force that was pre-assigned to being the way it was being is now available for response to life.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's amazing. That's when you see, you know, patients' lives change.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they don't have to, they're not weighed down by this current viewing platform any longer. Yeah.
Thank you, Alice. That was really interesting and informative. And thank you very much for your time. If you'd like any more information about the Institute of Classical Osteopathy and the courses we run, please go to our website, which is www.classical-osteopathy.org. Thank you very much. Bye.